Refuge Radio is a podcast about the National Wildlife Refuge Association and the nation's National Wildlife Refuge System, a system spanning more than 850 million acres of land and water as part of a growing network of 568 refuges, at least one in every state. Now let's join the show.
Thank you for listening to Refuge Radio. The following conversation is one between myself and Chad Brown, a board member at the Refuge Association. We cover some pretty heavy topics, and we want to make sure that you're aware of them before we get into it. We talk about depression, homelessness, and even self-harm. If you or a loved one suffer from depression, PTSD, or has thoughts of self-harm, we encourage you to reach out to a mental health professional, and there are links in the show notes if you need them. We see you, and you are not alone. The views expressed in this podcast do not reflect the views of the National Wildlife Refuge Association, its board, or staff. With all the housekeeping out of the way, we hope you enjoy this discussion with Chad Brown of Soul River.
Hi, Chad. How are you?
I'm doing good. How are you guys?
Good. Thanks for joining. We're going to introduce our distinguished board member, Chad Brown, from Soul River. We want to thank him for joining us today on Refuge Radio. This is the first in a series of podcasts that are focused on equity, inclusion, and diversity in the outdoors, as well as racial justice, and how we in the conservation movement and the National Wildlife Refuge System can better address these issues in a real way and not a technocratic way. So this is all about real conversations, real solutions. Now is not the time for talk, it's more for action. So I'd like to get started by asking you, Chad, to introduce yourself a bit to our audience and talk about, you know, what you've been doing with your time at Soul River and maybe what the impetus was behind the creation of that organization. So I'll give it over to you.
Yeah, my name is Chad Brown. I'm president and founder of Soul River, Inc., which is a nonprofit merges youth of color from urban neighborhoods that are disconnected from the outdoors. And we bring them into wild spaces along with the mentorship and guiding of veterans. We use veterans as life coaches, and they step into these youth lives, and the goal is to raise a youth into an outdoor ambassador or leadership of conservation, and to help guide that youth into internships and potential opportunities of college, career backgrounds, our career focus into conservation worlds. How we do this is we call them deployments, and which is a term that we use, which that's what the military use when they're going to war. But our war with the organization is an environmental war, you know, and we identify wild spaces that are at threat, our wildlife, freshwater, you know, any kind of environmental issues that are happening. And we bring youth and veterans into those spaces, and we use what's negative in those environments and roll it into a curriculum. And that veteran uses that curriculum to help engage our youth or inform our youth with what's going on. And the youth are also tasked to do research in those wild spaces. And they are tasked to not just do the research, but also to develop their own curriculum and their own class. And so when it comes down time for the youth to step up and share, they actually step up to teach a class of what they are learning about the environment, and us veterans take a step back to sit down, and we become the pupil and they become the teacher. And so we do this kind of like exchange of learning slash mentorship, life coaching. And our ultimate goal is giving space for our youth to be able to exercise their mind, their thoughts, explore their leadership personalities, guided by veterans. And when we come back from our deployment, we will set up meetings with congressional members and allow, a space of confidence for youth to be able to step in those spaces and be able to exercise now their voice from their experiences of being on our public lands and wild spaces, mentored by veterans.
Thank you. It's an amazing organization. Obviously, we'll put links to the show notes about your work. One of the things for me getting into this work and how I've been thinking about racial justice and environmental justice in particular is, in my experience, my personal experience, is that how I do this and how I view barriers to inclusion in the outdoors is very much informed by my own experience as a child in the outdoors. And I was wondering for you, if there's one experience in the outdoors that you can point to that has galvanized you and pushed you through wanting to do this work. So is there an experience in your youth that has made you want to, you know, create this leadership around youth? Is it something that you were looking for as a young person, that that's what you're trying to provide now?
You know, my experience is a little bit all over the place in a way. you know, I founded the organization off of circumstances of being in a really tough place as a veteran and being stripped down of basically of mental illness, dealing with as a PTSD, 50% mentally disabled, and also homeless here in Portland, living on the streets and for 12 months of my time, to a point where the cops found me and I was about to take my life. And so when that happened in my life, I was hauled off to the VA. And from there, a friend of mine took me to the river and said, this is, you know, I used to come to the river dealing with my issues. And, you know, and it would help me get through what I was going through, you know? And so when I said that, and when that person said that, I was like, well, how do you get into fishing? You know? And so just behind me, there was a fishing shop, and we went over there and I got me a rod and reel and, you know, two and two together, and had a great time on the water, hooked on the fish, and it just made me, stoked, excited. And through that process became a good 4 or 5 years of my walk. And I actually got a prescription from the VA saying to fish more in the outdoors and stuff. And so that's what led me to building the organization. And when I got to a place of healing and got to a place of clarity in my understanding, I was then saying, okay, well, this is what I want to do of moving forward into opening up and doing my own organization and working with youth of color and veterans. And my whole reason is because the reason I started earlier, if I'm a little bit different all over the place, my natural upbringing is I come from a family of farmers and hunters and black cowboys. My grandfather was a black cowboy, and I was raised up around black rodeos, you know, and my mom had a balance, and my father was a hunter, farmer, and my mom was an artist. And so there was this really interesting mix of hippie and hunter coming together, they understood who they were raising up, because it was just me and my brother, and they were very much rooted into, being black outdoors on the land, et cetera, and understood that, the slavery and the racism and everything that was happening. And so we operated and functioned in black outdoor spaces, like black rodeos, you know, and cowboy. And that was the space that we operated in as I was being brought up, and my father would make it aware to me that, he's always told me about, when you get older and get out into this world, we'd be on the land or somewhere out in the pasture around the cows, and I'm helping my dad or my grandpa bring it. He says, you know, when you leave here, you know, you're safe, but when you leave here, I need you to focus on your education. I need you to go as far as you can with your education, because it's your education is what's going to help you fight the hate and ignorance as a black man going through this life here, that was kind of like my upbringing. My father would talk to me like, you know, having black skin, you will be a target. You will have to deal with these kind of issues, of what society is going to throw at you in white America, and so my father would, train me in a way to help me be able to know what to do and how to do it if I get pulled over by the cops. How to position yourself, where to put your hands, where not to put your insurance and your ID card, et cetera, but you should keep it above you. That way it would eliminate your reach and it would eliminate the conspiracy or whatever and make the cop not to put his hand on the weapon. You need to do everything you can, default to yes, sir, or no, sir, and so those are a lot of the things that he would teach me coming up and being on land. And the outdoors was our place where we found comfort, but beyond that, it was not comfortable. You know, I was growing up with the stories of my father and me actually, you know, what they were teaching me and showing me, but I also witnessed the white sheets that would come and put the crosses out into the yard and my father grabbing the shotgun and he's coming out to protect the family, et cetera, you know, and trying to scare my father and my grandpa. But let alone, this is land, this is black owned land that's generational, that's been passed down from my great grandfather to my grandfather. And if you go through the land, you'll see slaves. And there's like a half a mile from my daddy's land. When every time I go back, he will actually take me out to the graveyard and he would walk me down to the slaves that came and that was part of the Brown family line. And he'll talk about the slaves and bring them all the way up to where my grandfather and my grandma is lying at rest right now, you know? So, mm-hmm. In the black rodeo, my dad was, you know, he would get out and wrestle bulls, you know, and I got crazy memories of that, you know, but yeah, so that was like my whole deal, you know, of understanding, you know, where I was at as a young black boy growing into manhood and how my father would play a role in teaching me and my mom and grooming me for what I'm going to be facing as a black male coming into this world with black skin and understanding what that means and how that signals out to many different people who are not black, you know, and so they did everything they can to help raise me the best. And then the rest was like a lot of trial and error, you know, yeah. But hope I answer your question.
It's interesting because it sounds like you started in a place where the outdoors was a place of comfort and it's something you came back to after experiencing trauma and then wanting to share that with other people and maybe working with younger folks to get ahead of that sort of thing. So you touched on something which is safety in the outdoors, which I think is something that fundamentally is what we're talking about one of the big barriers is people not feeling safe in the outdoors, and that can manifest in a whole number of ways. And so for me, not just as a woman, you know, an Asian woman, but somebody who presents as certain ethnicities, which is something that I've experienced, which is a lot of people don't really acknowledge that, is that when I'm in the outdoors, people will assume I am Latina or that I'm Native American, and they associate me with landscapes in different ways like that. But as a woman, the idea of safety in the outdoors is very fraught because when I was living in New England, I wanted to go hiking on the Appalachian Trail. I'm very much a loner in the outdoors. I'll maybe go with a friend, but I really like being out in nature by myself. There were all these reports of women just being shot in their tents, you know, on the Appalachian Trail. There was like serial killers and stuff. So there's this really, you know, this idea of the outdoors is this safe place is just not the case for a lot of us, right? Because it's very much, you know, when you look at who the big conservation heroes are, we only hear about white cowboys. We don't hear about the Compton cowboys. I don't know if you've heard about, you know, them. You know, they're 10 miles away from me. There's a huge legacy of that here in Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. We don't hear about, we have this idea of the outdoors as being Teddy Roosevelt shooting a buffalo in the face John Muir, you know, exploring places. Yeah. Native voices are out. We don't see black people in the history of black folk, you know, in the outdoors. We don't really see that unless it's put into this white context, you know, sometimes of the refuge system where all these birders wanted it. So now it's here, you know? So I just wanted to get a sense from you Do you find that that fear is the one of the bigger mental barriers to the outdoors? And how do you deal with that on a practical level? How do you address that fear that people have?
You said a lot.
Let's just talk about fear as a barrier and how you personally address that with the people who are involved in your programs.
Sometimes it's kind of hard to address that fear, but when it comes, you try to have to do the best that you can. You're dealing with the generational fear, especially, we're working with youth of color that's tied with the youth. It's also their parents. Their parents are from, Hispanic, African, especially African-American. They're operating from a different space of generational fear that's tied into, as you said earlier, women getting shot and tied into slavery. It's tied into, the fear of old school, of getting hung by, the KKK, all the kinds of stuff that happened. So all of that has never been found closure. No one never been able to find the closure of feeling like, okay, and where they can be able to move forward. It's just the fears enrolling itself over every generation. So here we are in, 2021, dealing with that same fear as my grandma talked about and, the mom and dad talked about, and now that the kids are talking about it, and it's a real fear. I think the only way that's been actually dealt with to deal with fear is in the outdoors, is in groups. When you have groups of your own people, everybody feels there's a sense of more safety going into outdoors than going by themselves, which is why you find a lot of POC groups that are, backpacking groups and fly fishing groups or whatever, hunting groups, et cetera. But you find them always get together because they feel safe going into outdoors together instead of going by themselves. I would chuckle when I would come across a white person and, they're talking about, oh, it was so great on the trail and they by themselves. And it could be a man and a woman, either one, and they're both saying the same thing. I say, yeah, I just feel so relaxed, et cetera. It's really interesting because I could never feel relaxed when I'm going on the trail or doing that by myself. I don't know what that means to feel relaxed. Yeah. I'm on guard. I'm on guard, I'm well versed in the backcountry outdoors. I know how to handle myself, but even me, I get in spaces talking to other brothers and sisters or just, a lot of folks of, diversity groups, and we talk and we laugh about it, but, it's like, yeah, it's, we don't want to, recreate that movie Deliverance, and stuff like that. And so, of course, movies don't help, but there's a fear, and it's a real fear. And it's something that's real to people of color, but it never really gets talked about. It's an unheard voice amongst each other when they're conversating and everything like that. But it never really gets talked about. It's something that we all kind of acknowledge together of the POC, community, everything like that, but there's a real fear, and that fear has a lot to do with the history. Mm-hmm. Our public lands is soaked in blood. A lot of bad things has happened, and throughout so many years, if we're going to look at slavery, et cetera, anywhere from 200 to 400 years, there's never been a closure. It's never been a closure. There's never been any place where anyone can be able to find comfort. And so by that being said, and no closure, nothing like that, it's a fear that resonates generationally that just flows itself into the next generation and to the next generation. And the only way to stop that is to help POC, whites and POC come together and help find closure to that and find a place of healing, with that. And that's really what's going to happen. That's some work. That's work that got to be put in place. And that will take time, But until then, what do we do when we go enjoy the outdoors? We come together in groups and we go out, and that's probably the only way we can find safety amongst ourselves to feel comfortable and to enjoy. Mm-hmm. And to POC who knows how to explore and navigate the backcountry by themselves, a lot of them, including myself, you carry. And it's sometimes funny because I've talked to some guys, it's like, we're talking about carrying, and And one guy said, "You know, it's not the animals you got to watch out for, you know, you know." And it's so true, you know, because you know, and so someone's not going to care because I'm watching bear. Well, bear doesn't want to have nothing to do with it, you know, and they really don't, you know. They want to get away from you, you know. Mm-hmm. And the same thing with a cougar, you know, have that, you know, that kind of stuff, you know. So really, it's the people. There is a percentage of people that does not accept nor acknowledge you of the color of your skin. Mm-hmm. And it's all ignorant. It's just bad education. It could, you know, this is stuff that we're talking about, kind of like a generational of ignorance, like a disease, basically. Mm-hmm. And to this day in 2020, we have people that still operates in that kind of negative mindset. And so when you got people in the urban world, and I'm saying the urban world because it's the outdoors, yes, it has its own history, but it's people in the urban world that are workers, everything from plumbers, lawyers, policemen, whatever the case is, that ignorance lies in the mindset of these people in the urban world that partakes in the recreation on our public lands. So they're transferring that mindset into these public land spaces with that negative thought process towards Black skin. And so now we got racial type of issues in the outdoors. And so it carries itself over really easy. And nobody doesn't really do anything about that, you know? And so now we have to create safety. And how do we create safety? We have to find safety within our groups. And if you're not in the groups, you're by yourself, you find safety the best way you can. If you carry, that's your ideal way of safety. You don't have no intentions of probably wanting to use it, et cetera, like that. But it actually kind of, it levels the playground, especially even if you're as a woman in backcountry, it does level the playground. Mm-hmm. It gives you something to stand on. And for you to have an opportunity to give out a warning and let the person know, because it levels the playground just by giving out a warning shot. It gives you that opportunity to escape, to walk away. And it's the same thing with, you know, a Black male or an Asian male, whatever, that's out there in backcountry. It levels the playground that will allow you to give an opportunity to come home.
We'll take a short break and be back with Angie and Chad Brown shortly.
And I think it feeds itself a little bit, because when you are out there by yourself or with a group, you're still, it's almost like a curiosity. You know, because our view of the outdoorsman is a white guy with a shotgun.
Yeah,
if it's a Black man or a woman with a gun, people are like, "Oh, that shouldn't be," and so they get nervous, yes. Right? They think you're up to no good. Yeah,
yeah,
You know what you said about you defending yourself was interesting too, because one of the things that struck me is that, you know, the takeover of the wildlife refuge a couple of years ago in Oregon, you know, if that had been people of color with guns taking it over, there wouldn't have been a standoff. People would have just been frog marched out of there immediately.
To be honest with you, I don't think it'd be march. I think it would have been a massacre.
It would have been a massacre. Yeah.
Yeah. It would have been, because the CIA, I mean, if you look at our history, in urban civilization throughout marches, MLK, Malcolm X, and everything in history that has happened in the streets has always been very brutal, very ugly, you know, has never been, even Martin Luther King's quiet protests, et cetera, that's never been a pretty situation either, you know, and so on top of that, you had FBI, you have CIA, you have Secret Service, you have all this kind of stuff coming into the mix, and there's been a lot of killings, right? So when you look at that, I mean, history gives you a really good answer of what it would look like if you saw a bunch of brothers and sisters, POC, taking over refuge.
Yeah.
There's a, you know, history will give you the answers, and what will happen is really not an easy walkout. Mm-hmm. You know, it would probably be a massacre. Authorities won't have a problem drawing their arms and locking and loading and shooting. Mm-hmm. That won't be a problem, because when you look at the history, it tells you what's going to happen. There's never been any government or police or CIA or whatever, there's never been anyone that had stepped in and walked that line with peace. Mm-hmm. There's never been peace. There's been nothing but a lot of frustration, a lot of killings, and a lot of pain and hurt. A lot of pain and hurt, you know? Mm-hmm. And so, but yeah, that whole Malheur thing, it would not have been good. And the only reason why they that authorities and stuff like that, they didn't shoot first and ask questions, is because there's a lot has to do with being white. Mm-hmm. In America, we have families, we got, you know, POC has powerful influenced families too, you know. Mm-hmm. But we would not get the status of a holdout, you know, situation, you know. But that family, the Malheur takeover, et cetera, you know, they have, it's, yeah, family, but the reason why they didn't shoot first and ask questions, because the fact that, you know, there's a white privilege there. There's a white privilege that comes into play, and that white privilege can easily create speed mm-hmm. bumps. It can create speed bumps and allow a little bit more space of conversating, mm-hmm. a little bit more space of talking and reasoning. But with our skin color, POC, that's a whole different ballgame. We don't get that space. We don't get that space to have a conversation or, you know, or say, oh, let's have a negotiation. Mm-hmm. We don't get that opportunity, you know? And so, but yeah, it's a little bit unfair.
You know? To say the least, yeah. And the thing that's really amazing to me is, you know, the wildlife refuge takeover was connected to a previous standoff that happened in outside of Las Vegas, what, a year before the actual takeover of the refuge. And it was mm-hmm. the same family. It was the patriarch of the family. And that standoff was over grazing. The privilege of a white landowner who inherited his land from settlers who were there illegally and then claiming the land as his, and then deciding not to pay his grazing fees, and then going into a standoff with the U.S. government over it and successfully pulling it off. That is the height of privilege.
It's the height of privilege, and I don't get it.
Yeah.
I don't really, when someone say, get off of my land,
yeah.
When someone say, get off of my river, I still don't understand the ownership right there.
Right.
I don't get it. You know, I really don't get, like, how is this yours? How is this free flowing river? How is this yours? You know, it doesn't make sense to me, but mm-hmm. but whites, you know, not all whites, but whites that are in those spaces, there's this sense of ownership, this mentality of this ownership that's not really theirs. Mm-hmm. And I don't get why that ownership comes out so strong to where if I'm hiking on this trail by default, and not even consciously thinking, but there's this default to falling back and saying, why are you on my trail? Mm-hmm. This is public land I'm on.
Right.
And so I don't get that. You know, it really confused me, because I've been told that a lot. Get off of my river. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, why you're in my outdoor space? Your outdoor, I just have to think about that. You know, it really doesn't make sense to me. Yeah.
Well, I think you've hit on a really good point. And since this conversation is about the history and how we got here, you know, we're going to talk about solutions, but I think it's really important to unpack the whole concept of property ownership, the colonial idea that you can come over and put a homestead somewhere and that land is yours.
Right. Right.
It's a very white concept. You know, it was, you know, the indigenous people didn't have a concept of ownership of land. It belonged to everybody. You know,
right.
Tribes definitely had their preferred hunting grounds and they had their areas of spirituality, but they all had an understanding that the land belonged to everybody. It was not
right.
one person's. And so you have this concept of manifest destiny that informed it informs our public lands today, which is that this idea that if you're a white citizen in the United States, public lands are yours in a sense of you own them. And you're able to tell other people that they cannot be on it. And I think for me, that's how I think about it, is that these people really do believe when they say this land is your land, this land is my land, they actually believe it in a sense of ownership and not in a sense of sharing. I do think that, again, I wasn't raised in that tradition. You know, my two white grandfathers were, one was raised in a very dense part of South Philadelphia and didn't have any public lands to speak of around. And my other one was, raised in rural Nebraska. Like, his father didn't even have a birth certificate because the family settled there when it was still a territory and worked the land. So his ideas of ownership were also very not common. You know, it was like you had this, you know, you shared it with your neighbors and you worked it and that was it. There was a connection to it. And then my grandmothers are both, you know, immigrants, and they have a different, they don't have a sense of ownership of land. They see it as holistic, you know, part of your life. You know, and it's funny because they understood Southern California water issues better than anyone around them. Because where they came from, these places of marginal, you know, they lived with the environment, within the environment, know, extreme environments. My grandmother was telling me once they lived on locusts for a month. Just eating bugs, literally. That's how close to the land they were. And I just get a sense, I think that's where it comes from. That's my offering to this, is the idea of ownership of land is because people are raised to believe that the land is theirs, whether they actually physically own it or not. Exactly. It's more of a tradition that's passed down. Like for us, it's passed down for us to be fearful of the outdoors. It's not ours. But for a lot of white people, they're brought up to believe that it is theirs. It belongs to them. And I think I'm going to pivot this to the Christian Cooper situation in New York, because I think that's connected a little bit, is that you have this man who's on the board of Audubon and he's out looking at birds in Central Park. And you have this white woman who's a Canadian national. She's not even American, but she's decided that park is hers, you know, essentially. Exactly. So I just, does that track for you, that sort of attitude? It's all connected to how people react in the outdoors, is that sense of the ownership and entitlement?
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. That, you know, there's a serious sense of entitlement and ownership, you know, I come across, and, you know, in the situation that happened in New York, again, that is also being white, that's generationally learned of racism and how white privilege has that opportunity to leverage and weigh in to get what they want and dismantle others at the same time. Her being Canadian, she learned that, you know, that was something that she learned how to use to her advantage. And so it's really, and that's a problem, because all of that behavior is so much learned that gives you a really good lens to see how much work is going to take to unlearn that. Just as much as I come into this world with black skin and understanding and being taught my disadvantage and the barriers that I'm going to be facing, is just as much as that white person comes into this world and is taught how much of advantage that he or she has, you know, on top of superiority mindset of you are more superior than these races. You can do this because this, they may not say because you're white, but there's like, you have this advantage. You can go here, you can go here. And, you know, no telling how the teachers are in homes like that. But, you know, her being Canadian is, I'll be good at saying this, but she probably learned a lot of that by watching television, you know, watching media, you know, and, you know, when you travel overseas and stuff, I hate to say it though, but African Americans tends to be put into some really interesting buckets, because people learn about African Americans when they're watching the movies, you know, and not every African American is a basketball player. Not every African American is a thug or whatever you want to call it, but they tend to be put them in buckets like that, you know, from the visual language that they see. And so I don't know her upbringing, but how she's responded out, all of that stuff that's learned behavior. And she learned it well, how to use her white privilege, basically. And fortunately, that's been going on for years. They were just lucky that was caught on video, mm-hmm. you know? And that's the advantage that we have today, that we can use, you know, technology to help us out. But those stories and that cry of her, you know, calling the cops, the sad thing is that we got prisons filled with a bunch of Black males that are innocent, you know, and they easily got put into the system, you know, really, really easily get put into the system. It scares me to death, even today, me being Black in America and the things that I do and the spaces I'm in, I have to consciously think and try to be as careful as possible. Sometimes, you know, in situations to not allow myself in situations like that, but there are also some situations that you just don't have control over either. And I think the worst fear is to be caught by myself with a white person, male or female, under a certain situation where it becomes your word versus his word, you know? And that's a scary place to be, of, you know, being a person of color. Really scary place, you know? You know, and because that Karen that got on the phone and wanted to call the cops on that, you know, that Black guy, that can happen to any of us. And that has happened many a times, you know? And so, yeah, there's a lot of Karens out there, mm-hmm. you know?
Yeah. And I don't think they even realize, well, what they learn and internalize is, I mean, this has been going on for so long, but I mean, you know, going back to Emmett Till, you know, yeah, the woman yeah. who accused, like, she turns out later that she's lying her ass off. And, you know, this yeah. boy died. And yeah. and how many Emmett Tills do we not know about is right. my fear. How many do we not know that are in prison right now? For right. Yeah. So I think, you know, what happened in that in Central Park to me is just part of that unfortunate long tradition in history of women saying false crap about Black men. and automatically, you know, it's yeah, it's like you said, it's good that there's video out there, because that could have turned out very differently, for sure.
Absolutely, it could have turned out very different. And you know, the sad thing is that Black guy, he's you could tell that when, you know, you learn about him, he's an educated man, he's mm-hmm. a stand-up citizen, you know, he's accomplished, he's successful. But if it wasn't for that video, mm-hmm. he would be having a hard time. He would be put in the system really, really quick.
Yeah.
So the best that you can do of being white is to listen and hold space and digest what I'm talking about here. Because for you to actually respond from an emotional preamp response tells me that you're not taking the time to really understand where I'm coming from, because it's hard for you to relate already, because I'm operating from a space of being Black in America. That's where I'm operating. Now, the politics can easily come into places, because me being Black in America is what I'm facing with Black skin of being a target in America moving through urban world. When I step into the outdoor world, I am moving through the same barriers in the outdoor world of having, again, Black skin, okay? There is a barriers that cross over from the outdoor world into public land space. It doesn't matter if I'm on the national park land, if I'm a BLM land, refuge land, having Black skin is a different experience compared to having white skin. It's a big difference, okay? And when I'm on public land with Black skin, my experience is a little bit more different than a white person, because I'm having to deal with racial stuff on public land. I'm dealing with ignorance. I'm dealing with people, you know, that are telling me to get off of my river, and all I want to do is fly fish. I'm dealing with people when I'm coming back seeing the word nigger on my car spray painted. I'm dealing with letters saying, you know, we don't want you here, blah, 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 blah. And I'm dealing with the dismantle of my brake lines being dismantled when I'm coming back, et cetera. So there's a lot of stuff that comes into play. And so when we're talking about it doesn't exist, or we're talking about you know, the politics and all that kind of stuff. Well, yeah, there's social justice, environmental justice that we're dealing with that comes in both spaces. And the best thing for you to really understand, if you have the time to understand of being white, is to hold some space a little bit and think about this a little bit deeper than what you normally can revert to in your world. Because I'm not asking you to look at your world. I'm asking you to look at our world of having black skin, our world of having brown skin, you know, our world of having different culture. So there's two different walks here, two completely different walks, you know. And if you're closed up and you're not wanting to allow yourself to see that, then you will default to that response that they put on Facebook, because that's where they feel comfortable in, and that's where they feel where they can have a platform. I'm asking you to step into a space. I'm asking you to step into a space where it's going to make you feel uncomfortable. You know, that's what I'm asking. It's going to make you feel, and it should make you feel uncomfortable, because this is how we've been feeling for 200-400 years of feeling uncomfortable. Black and brown skin, indigenous people, you know, culturally, etc. We've been feeling uncomfortable so much that it become our norm. And that's the sad thing. And it shouldn't be our norm, you know, and everything like that, you know. And so if that makes you feel uncomfortable for 30 minutes or for 3 minutes to read that article, then that's a good thing, you know. But if it makes you not want to step into that uncomfortable space, and you want to take a sit down in your privileged space, where you don't have, you got a choice. You have a choice to not lean in to what I'm talking about. You got that choice. You also have a choice to go, I'm gonna go down to Starbucks and get me a cup of coffee and enjoy my day. You got a choice. You know, you really do. Yeah. You know, and everything like that. But if you want to make the best of your day, to be productive and be on the good fight, to where you say, you know what, I believe in humanity. I believe in, you know, black lives. I believe in indigenous lives. I believe in, you know, of coming together, unity, building community. Then this space that makes you feel uncomfortable is one more space to add into your belief that you believe that you want to step into this space to learn more,
yeah,
you know, and yeah, be part, you know, and that's that. So, yeah.
I found it interesting that some people took it as a, to me, if you're feeling uncomfortable or called out, then it's probably because something, a truth hit too close to home. And I think some of these comments were definitely like, if your comment was threatening to them, that says more about them than it does anything else.
Yeah.
So the idea that people are putting politics onto these things, saying like, oh, Chad said this, so he must hate my choice for president. It's like, you didn't say anything like that in your statement. You know, it's like, what did he say? That politician, he said, a hit dog will holler. Andrew wow. Gillum, I think.
This has nothing, it's, wow. Yeah, I need to go on to you guys. Look at it. That's interesting.
You'll see it. It's just like, you know, it's like, why would people feel personally attacked by you making a statement? To me, that says that they're very uncomfortable because they feel like they're being accused of something.
Yeah.
And to me, that defensiveness goes hand in hand with the entitlement.
Yeah, exactly. It has nothing to do with Trump, even though Trump's president. But I didn't say anything in that article about Trump.
No, you didn't. It was just so funny, is that just reading the headline, people assumed that that's what it was about. One of the reasons I wanted to have this conversation with you is that it's like, we don't have to mention specific politicians. We're not talking about that. But if you're taking our statements that way, then that says a lot about you think about the world.
You're right. And you know what? If you're taking a statement that way,
yeah,
you have to come to places like, not everything is going to center around you.
Yes.
It's not about you. Yep. It really isn't. And I think the only thing in that article, and I didn't spend that much time on it, I just started at the top. The only thing that's in relation to what anybody, if you want to put your finger on anything of today in our society, is what happened to George.
Yes.
I spoke to that as a title, thoughts about George and the killing, blah, blah, blah. Yeah. You know, and the reason why, and if you read that article in the Word and everything of my words, it's a reflection that I identify with as a Black man mm-hmm. with Black skin, because I'm just as much as a target, just like George. And there's a lot of other brothers out there that can identify with George. There's a lot of sisters out there that can identify with George. People say, you know, a lot of folks in it. And George, again, I spoke in an article, it's the tipping point. His death opened up the tipping point, which I've referred to Martin Luther King's quote, riots is the voice of unheard voices, something like that, in relationship, because the fact that when that happened, that article's not about George, it's about the tipping point, you know, not just me, but the unheard voices. There was a lot of stuff going on, and George just gave this tipping point, and it just opened up this massive floodgates of unheard voices over years. Mm-hmm. Black women, indigenous women, indigenous men, Black men, Hispanic men, Hispanic families, you know, every person of color generationally has been voicing, raising their voice, asking for help. Can we help push this bill to open this up? Can we get funding for the children here in this urban community? You know, I mean, on so many different levels, it opened up the floodgates, you know? No one doesn't talk about, because I talk about it, I did mention in my article, no one doesn't talk about the indigenous. That's interesting. People looked over, no one don't say anything about that. But I mentioned it really lightly about the mysteries of the unheard voices of indigenous women. No one doesn't talk about it, but it's so real.
Yeah.
No, it's so real. It's so much that, you know, again, people's in that privileged space, they turn their cheek the other direction, act like nothing doesn't exist, but it really does exist. Yeah. You know, it really does. And so my article, and to anybody that's listening, reread that article, but before you respond, I'm asking you to go deep. I'm asking you to go deep into a really uncomfortable space here, to step out of your norm of how you operate in your perfect, beautiful house, space, office, whatever the case is. I'm asking you to go into a dark place and hold space for these voices. Hold space for myself as a Black man and other Black men that relate to George. I'm asking you to hold space for the fact that we need you to help bridge this gap, because we are dealing with hate, bigotry, racism, and ignorance every freaking day. It's part of our walk, and people of color are tired of that. And we need to try to find a better way to where we can be able to work together to help dismantle, because the only way we're going to be able to dismantle all of this stuff that's happening and everything is coming together, is unity, unified one another, and step into the space of love. I say this all the time, love is king. And I'm not talking about the relationship of marriage or boy and girl, whatever. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about it takes a certain type of strength in the side of a person to step in with heart for one another in order to dismantle the fear, the pain, the ugliness, the hate, the racism, and the ignorance. It takes a love to be able to take care of that. It takes a strength, you know, and not everybody can tap into that, you know. Not everybody's going to be able to walk that walk, you know. It took me almost 12 hours to write that article. I went through a lot of, you know, a lot of drafts. It was emotional for me, heavy emotion for me. I stopped a couple times. I got back on it, you know, and it took me 12 hours, you know, And so me putting my time and writing that article, if you got if you took 3 minutes to read that piece, and you can sit there and type within 3 minutes your response to something that's totally irrelevant, you just disrespected everything that's been created. That article requires you to go into a deeper space. It requires to exercise your mind. I'm exercising your thought process of you being white to actually think a little different here and trying to figure out where and what is going on here. This is bigger than just me. This is a vehicle that you can get in and drive through our world here.
Make sure to tune in to the next episode of Refuge Radio for the rest of my discussion with Chad Brown from Soul River, Inc.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Refuge Radio, the podcast of the National Wildlife Refuge Association. You can find Refuge Radio wherever you listen to podcasts. Be sure to check out some of our awesome shows from refuges all across the country. If you have a comment about this episode or an idea for a future podcast, drop us a line at refugeradio@refugeassociation.org. And to learn more about our work, go to refugeassociation.org and consider donating. Until next time, we'll see you on a refuge.